Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's my great pleasure to have Gary Groth with me. Gary Groth is one of the founders, and now I believe the editor-in-chief, of Fantagraphics Books. In 1991, Art Spiegelman came on to Bookworm. Mouse 2 had just appeared in book form. I was all sorts of doubtful about this thing that was not yet called the graphic novel. And so Art took me in hand and introduced me to the work of the cartoonists he particularly admired. Those included Chris Ware and Dan Clowes and Charles Burns, among many, many others. And, well, I was dazzled. And gradually I came to realize that most of these cartoonists either began or were published by Fantagraphics Press. And over these 30 years that we've been doing the show, I keep encountering Fantagraphics, Fantagraphics, Fantagraphics. They've published the complete R. Crumb, but they're not all one thing. They've just finished publishing the complete Charles Schulz, the complete Peanuts. And the books that they do are beautifully done. And so I thought it was time to have the editor of Fantagraphics on the show, because there's been so much amazing work that's come from this independent publisher located in Seattle, yes?
That's correct.
Now tell me, I'm going to ask the hardest question first. Given now that we're in a new age of comics, what makes a good comic? When you're looking at a book that's been submitted to you, what is it you're looking for?
I think the easiest way to answer that is to say that we look for a singular vision that is beautifully and appropriately executed. So I think it's as simple as that.
Now, Fantagraphics has always, for practical reasons and impractical ones as well, been on high levels and low levels. Because to keep an experimental comics company alive, you may find yourself for 3 or 4 years publishing Eros comics. And they may be by great comics people, but the pornographic appeal sells the books. Has this changed? Is there now an audience for graphic novels?
It has changed, I think. You know, what you're referring to is, we never had any money. We never had any funding. When we started publishing, and I co-founded the company, starting with the Comics Journal, which was a critical magazine about comics in 1976, we never had any money. And we would periodically have financial crises because the kinds of books we wanted to publish, which were throughout most of our history not the kinds of books the reading public understood or wanted to buy, but which we passionately believed in and wanted to publish, couldn't sustain a real company. They couldn't sustain overhead, they couldn't sustain employees and everything that went into it. So we would periodically have financial crises. And what you were referring to is at one point, I think it was 1990, we had another financial crisis and we started publishing an imprint called Eros Comics, which was our X-rated comics. And that literally sustained us for another decade. it's gotten to the point now where I think there is a growing awareness among the literate reading public as to what a graphic novel, and this is so complicated because there's so many different kinds of graphic novels, but I'm talking about a literary or artistic graphic novel, for want of better terms. And I think there is a growing public who appreciates and understands this and is becoming large enough to sustain such books.
Not only did the Spiegelman recommendations lead me to the Acme Novelty Library, which published segment by segment the Jimmy Corrigan adventures of Chris Ware. And the books were so beautiful. I remember Françoise Mouly, Art Spiegelman's wife, showing me a centerfold of a snowstorm in Chicago in one of the Chris Ware books. And I was really hooked because something that looked that beautiful had to be beautiful in other ways as well, structurally, mentally. And it seemed to me then, when I started to look into Fantagraphics, not to be a surprise that they also publish fiction. They publish some of my favorite writers who also have trouble being published. Those include Alexander Theroux and Stephen Dixon. They're wonderful writers. And when they come from Fantagraphics, as they had come from McSweeney's as well, when the independents do them, the books are beautifully designed, complicatedly designed by people who understand that the content of a book has got to be reflected in its design.
We employ about 20 people in the company, and that includes editors, marketing people, and an art and design department, administrative people, accounting department. Our design has improved over the last 40 years. It started out with me being the designer, and I was very much a self-taught amateur designer. I think we probably hired our first truly professional designer in the mid to late 1980s. And our design, I think, has become more and more sophisticated from that point on. And at some point, we became very conscious that the design of the book has to be customized to the content of the book so that the design reflects the work itself. And we're very, very conscious of that.
I'm talking to Gary Groth, the editor-in-chief. Is that how you call yourself?
I'm the publisher, and I'm one of the two or three editors, yes. I select most of the material.
Of the fantastic, pardon me for saying so, Fantagraphics books, an independent comics publisher. I wanted to have him on. The occasion is that there's a book of collated interviews called We Told You So, Comics as Art. And almost everyone who could be reached who was associated with Fantagraphics remembers what it was like. In fact, rereading the Eros Comics section, it's a hilarious spectrum because some of the people are saying, we never wanted to do this. This was weird. I'm glad we did it under a different imprint. And the rest are saying, this is what I was looking forward to. I wouldn't have wanted to spend all that time doing avant-garde comics. I never understood them. It's a whole range of approaches. And of course, bridging that range is someone like R. Crumb, who is doing groundbreaking work in comics for his whole career and at the same time never abdicating what he regards as his responsibility to bad taste. Bad taste is very important. Too much refinement destroys comics, huh?
Yeah, in fact, it's you know, it's something that that concerns me and my small cohort of friends, that comics are actually becoming too respectable. That comics started out as being a very disreputable medium, and you know, of course, the signal event in the history of comics, I think, was the advent of underground comics in the 1960s. This is what really changed the course of comics. And underground comics were, by their very nature, disreputable because all of the cartoonists who were working in underground comics and created that movement were working in direct opposition to mainstream comics, you know, to the superhero comics, the genre comics, all the comics that were aimed at kids.
The immediate question to a book called We Told You So, Comics as Art. Now, there was a huge and years-long battle to get comics into museums. Here in Los Angeles, where the show comes from, the Hammer Museum had a huge exhibit, but it didn't come easily. You had to get all those curators to agree that comics are art. Now, what does art mean in that sentence, comics as art, to you?
It means that comics are capable of profound an expression as any other medium, as film, as literature, as music, as theater. And that's what, you know, when I started the Comics Journal in 1976, you can't imagine the kind of indifference, hostility, and contempt that comics were held in at that time. And I'm talking primarily about comic books. Newspaper strips were something slightly different. I mean, they had their own, you know, problems in the cultural hierarchy, but comic books were just looked upon with scorn by anybody who was interested in reading.
How many books would you say over the years has Fantagraphics put out, approximately?
It's a frightening number. When we put the list together, I remember being terrified because we put it together and our designer floated into the pages, and it's something like, I don't know, it's something like 25 pages in 6-point type. We were tempted to even put it on the web and not even put it in the book, as it took up so much paper.
But it's thousands.
Thousands, yeah. It is thousands of books.
Thousands of books over how many years?
Most of them good. Over 40 years. We celebrated our 40th anniversary last year.
Well, one of the things about Fantagraphics is that they are as committed to the present and future of this form of literature, art, but to the past as well. And so they publish, among other things, not just the Complete Art Crumb, but something that I adore, the Complete Popeye.
Oh, yeah.
I was so surprised at how good Popeye is.
I felt devoted to publishing the best comics throughout its history, and that meant comics in the past and contemporary cartoonists. We published Popeye. The Popeye you read is probably the Popeye we published recently, but we published Popeye in 1982, I think. And we published it. We published the Sunday pages in black and white because we couldn't afford color back then. But we thought it was an important strip and we wanted to publish it. We also published strips back then like Little Orphan Annie and Prince Valiant. And so we were devoted to publishing the best cartooning from any era. We published work from the 19th century as well. And to us, to my partner, Kim Thompson, and I, good cartooning was good cartooning. We wanted to resurrect these great cartoonists from the past, people like E.C. Segar, who did Popeye, George Harriman, who did Crazy Cat. We published Winsor McCay, did Little Nemo in Slumberland.
Oh, I'm so
and they
glad.
Were as important as, you know, the cartoonists that we were discovering.
I don't think I could live without Little Nemo as an example of the entrance of dream into something other than surrealism. Dream as a metaphor for childhood. Little Nemo yes. are incredibly beautiful, colorful, unforgettable strips. They look like peacock tails, some of them. They're magnificently colored and beautifully imagined. Also, you know, there was just a brilliant biography of George, how do you say
Harriman?
The cartoonist who did Crazy Cat. Almost no one looking at Crazy Cat, and Crazy was beloved by people as widely apart as E.E. Cummings. I mean, all sorts of poets and writers and drama people loved Crazy Cat, and none of them knew that Harriman was half black.
Right.
And this is the subject, the inner subject of this biography, Crazy Cat as an implicit critique of America. Claiming things for art is a special project, I think, and it's not easy to do because people have such uppity ideas about what art is. And then again, they have even more uppity ideas about what art isn't.
And Crazy Cat was one of the few strips that transcended the prevailing prejudice against comics as art. I mean, even though I think there were some extraordinary strips, I mean, I think Crazy Cat is one of the greatest comic strips ever drawn. But there were strips
that could... Crazy Cat is one of the greatest anythings.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it really transcends. It happens to have been a cartoon strip, but it's among the best of whatever it might be.
Yes. But it did have competing strips like Little Nemo in Slumberland and Popeye, and a handful of others that people couldn't really accept as art. Crazy Cat is the one strip that for so many years proved that comics could be art.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Gary Groth, editor at Fantagraphics. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Gary Groth about Fantagraphics. He's the publisher of some of the world's greatest cartoonists and the history of some of its greatest scripts. Now, there's a picture in here of you and Al Capp, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true.
And what it brings up a subject because, you see, in New York, where I was a child, Al Capp and Lil Abner was printed in the Daily News. Newspapers were a matter of class. My neighbors were definitely lower class. The wife was a house cleaner. My parents were accountants. What did they do? They read the New York Post. The New York Post had Nancy, but it didn't have Lil Abner. Lil Abner was thrilling. Al Capp became ferociously disrespected because he was a patriot who supported the war in Vietnam. You would never have expected or known that if you had been reading Lil Abner in the 50s. Now, I wanted to talk to you about this because R. Crumb, you published the complete R. Crumb.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in at 22 pounds, I think I read. R. Crumb is now razzed for what's thought of as the racist and sexist contents of his cartoons. Is it the nature of disreputable art to come in and out of cultural currency?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the underground cartoonists were often transgressive, and they were transgressive even by the standards of the 60s and 70s, and of course far more so today in what are clearly more enlightened times. Crumb is a perfect example of that.
For better or for worse, comics represent a moment of transition between preteen and teenage. So all the people reading comics are coming into their sexual recognitions. When they're young, maybe they want to know Wendy the Good Little Witch, who's only defined by her floppy red hood.
Yes.
But gradually, you're looking to comics to teach you something about what no one else will tell you, I think. And I think that that's one of the reasons they remain so fascinating and so popular. I have to tell you, Gary, that nowadays I very rarely meet an intelligent young person, the kind of people who would be reading, say, William Burroughs, mm-hmm. or reading Nabokov or John Barth. They really know independent comics, and they want to draw them, and they're trying to find the door to beat on to get in, mm-hmm. because it is a part of their intellectual growth and understanding, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that?
Yeah, in my world, you can't throw a rock without hitting a aspiring cartoonist. I mean, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, there's good and there's bad in it. I mean, there's probably never been a time when so much good work has been produced, but there might also never have been a time when there's so much mediocre work being produced.
You know, Art sent to me a cartoonist who you published. His name is Olivier Schrauen.
Right.
I had to look at his books. What's the title?
It's actually Olivier Schrauen. The title is his name.
They are so wild and abstract and interesting. You really have to prepare yourself. I mean, there's something that happens in the pit of my stomach when I look at them, because they are so primal. There's something about childhood, growing up, mm-hmm. the parental combativeness between father and son. They're amazing things.
You know, I think he's challenging in the best possible way, because he's using the medium to its fullest capacity. He's actually using the visual components of comics in a way that is unorthodox. And as a result, you really have to pay attention. And, you know, if you read, I mean, most books, most movies, most comics, you don't really have to pay much attention. You can breathe through them, and that's what they're meant. That's how they're designed. That's how they're meant to do. His work challenges you.
You've just published a book by a new graphic novelist named Emile Ferris. Her book is called My Favorite Thing is Monsters. Now, I would have said that if there was any form or genre that was not susceptible to reconceptualization, mm-hmm. it was the monster comic. But here she's written the first volume, it's around 380-some pages, of a two-volume graphic novel that is using all the metaphors of transformation involving monsters. I know that this book was rejected by some of the major houses. What led you to see it? Because I know you say in We Told You So that you don't particularly like monster genres.
Well, that's true. That's a close reading of yours. Well, I got the book through an agent, And like the rest of the world, I had never heard of Emil. And we get submissions all the time, and they're almost always bad. And they're almost always rejected. So I got this submission. Now, I didn't know what to make of the title. I was a little put off by the title because it had monsters in the title, and I'm not particularly interested in monsters. And I thought, well, this could just be some rehash of some monster iconography in American pop culture. But the minute I started reading it, I thought that, you know, I was taken aback because the work is so undeniably, breathtakingly good. And she uses monsters as a metaphor.
Of every kind.
For many things, yes. And she uses monsters, the monster iconography in American pop culture from both magazines like Famous Monsters of Filmland and the monsters in films like The Wolfman and Dracula and so forth.
And takes them and makes it the case that the people of mixed sexuality, as they discover themselves, think of themselves as monsters, as living in the dark, as carrying on secret lives, as being frightening to others, as having cooties. And it's sort of, I mean, it is the most amazing book I've looked at in a couple of years, certainly the most amazing graphic novel. And to think of it as her first book is truly wonderful. We're going to be talking to her, but I kind of thank you for having the kind of house that would pick her out.
I mean, I knew when I read, even when I had, I don't know, I had gotten 20, 30, 40 pages into Emil's book, I knew we had to publish this book. And the kind of book that Emil does, and the kind of book that so many of our contemporary cartoonists do, is why we do what we do. It makes what we do important to us. And so thank God for artists like Emil.
I've been talking with Gary Groth, editor of Fantagraphics Books. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor.
You can comment on today's show or learn more about Fantagraphics at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm. My name is Bill Ferris is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.